Poet and painter Jose Faust was a 9-year-old from Bogota, Colombia, when he came to Kansas in 1965 and first encountered racism. He still reacts to the impact it has on people of color in this country.
I cried when Obama got elected president. I never thought I would see it in my lifetime. And what triggered my tears was to see Jesse Jackson holding this little American flag as the cameras are panning, and he's crying. Man. They just flowed out of me.
Tears aren't the only thing that flow out of Jose Faust. 20 of his colorful murals grace the Kansas City Metro, and he regularly reads his poetry as one of the founders of the Latino Writers Collective and former president of the Writers' Place. Stay with us to hear Jose Faust as he shares a migrant story and reads from his poetry book, The Life and Times of Jose Calderon, today on New Letters on the Air, a production of New Letters Magazine at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. I'm Angela Elam. I interviewed Jose Faust during UMKC's 2019 Alumni Week when he received the Defying the Odds Award, an honor that surprised him, as you'll hear shortly. First, we'll listen to a poem from his 2017 book, The Life and Times of Jose Calderon. I Remember Jackson, Mississippi recounts his first car ride from the southern border to Leavenworth, Kansas, where his new stepfather was stationed. It was the year after the 1964 murders of the 3 civil rights activists who were abducted and killed in Mississippi. This poem was triggered decades later when another brutal racist murder occurred just 2 counties away in Jackson, Mississippi. Here's Jose Faust reading that poem in front of an audience in UMKC Schofield Hall. Just to warn you, this reading does contain the offensive N-word 1 minute from now.
I remember Jackson, Mississippi. I know why there are things I know I am meant to know. It is a long trip through the South of 1965. In a 1956 Chevy. My brother and I are in the back, my mother's stepfather in the front, and he's telling us something. She nods with tears in her eyes, but he's telling me the gospel truth. There are people in this place that will see and not like the color of your skin. I remember clear as night the sign Jackson. He points and teaches me to say, Jackson, Jackson, one of my first words in English. I remember when I dated her blonde hair and gray eyes, I would visit up north outside St. Joe and lounge in her sister's yard in the burning afternoon sun. The end of summer, we broke up. Later, she told me how relieved her sister's in-laws were to not have to drive by the house and see the nigger on the lawn. When we lived in the suburbs, I had a friend who hated the lawn ornaments that dotted his neighbor's yards, black jockeys holding reins in their hands. When I stayed the night, we would get high and run out into the dark, smashing the sculptures with our bats. A fungo to the head is as good as any swing on cow hide. Some of the houses replaced them with other jockeys, but through the years we saw them disappear, replaced by gnomes, toads, and deer. I think of that trip and know what I am meant to know. 3 months after the bodies have been found, Shaney, Goodman, and Schwimmer in Neshoba County, Mississippi. It has been 45 years since I learned Jackson, and why he made me repeat it until it flowed like venom from my tongue. I understand why she cried and why I got such joy from smacking the heads off the lawn jockeys and watching them tumble and bounce lazy across the lawns.
I Remember Jackson, Mississippi. It's from the book The Life and Times of Jose Calderon by Jose Faust, and we're here on New Letters on the Air. It's a powerful poem.
This is all a true story. That was the first time I knew I was colored or had a color. My family is the way most families should be, I think. My uncle Rafa was a very dark-skinned man, but my cousins Patricia and Lenore had blue eyes, blonde hair. I just never grew up knowing color until I came here. And then that moment, it's like, that was the first time I knew that color was a thing. And it threw me off, messed me up for a while thinking about it. A lot of people get upset about Black Lives Matter and stuff like that, but you know, we haven't stopped. You can't look up and say, we're living in better times.
Yeah. I should let you know that Jose was born in Bogota, Colombia, and lived with his grandmother there until you were 9 years old.
Well, my mother moved here first.
Hadn't seen her for a lot of years when she moved
about
here.
About 3.5 to 4 years. I don't recall any trauma being attached to it. My mother was a dancer, so she danced professionally. And so there was travel, so my brother and I were used to being left with aunts and uncles. But when she left and came up here, I searched myself, and I can't think that I cried. There was no trauma really involved. The trauma came later when we came here.
Mm-hmm.
And then we realized we were kind of strangers to each other.
Yeah. Well, that makes sense because you had a family network at home and you were taken care of.
King Lear is one of my favorite plays of Shakespeare because there was this dynamic. There were four aunts and one uncle. The uncle picked up and moved away as far away as he could from the family. He went to Argentina. But that left my four aunts and my mother. My mother moved up here. And so there was always this rivalry between the four aunts. And my grandmother was like the matriarch, literally, of the whole family. I remember we would go from aunt's house to aunt's house and stay a while. And there was always a disruption. Because when my grandmother came in, she took over. You couldn't really fight her. And so when I read Lear, it really struck me, you know, those kind of sibling rivalries. And my grandmother was really good at exploiting them. And they took care of us, though, but that was nice, too.
That's probably how your grandmother kept all those girls in line, you know, was doing that.
You couldn't talk back to my grandmother. I made the mistake of always doing that. So she would call me Cuco, and she would always, she would grab that ear. Thought I was going to have a long ear. She came and visited us when I was a teenager, and the issues my mother and I had were obvious to my grandmother, and I think she was kind of disappointed to see that I talked back. So that was sad.
You have that other poem where she makes you say the rosary.
Oh, my God. My grandmother wanted a priest in the family, and my grandmother thought that, wouldn't it be just great if Jose was a... You know, I don't know why she didn't pick on my brother, Ramon.
Well, you're close, a priest and a poet. I mean, you know, they seem to be connected.
My grandmother used to, every night she would say the rosary. And so I was the only one of all my cousins. Every night she would put a little pillow on her floor, and I would not get the little pillow for my knees. And she would make me say the rosary with her. And God forbid those days when it was a novena. Because, you know, you just go around that rosary a few times more than once. I hated it. But it's interesting to me because I'm not really religious much. But the prayer, the Virgin's prayer, is kind of like a mantra to me. So whenever I feel any kind of doubt, or whenever I look for a higher guidance, that prayer just comes to me. That's kind of like my own. So I thank my grandmother for giving me that. You know.
Yeah.
But I hated it when I was growing up. My cousins used to make so much fun. They'd walk by, and I'd be sitting there saying the damn rosary and acting pious. I had to be very pious because my grandmother, if she didn't see piety, she... So it was a hit, yeah.
Yeah. I'm talking to Jose Faust for New Letters on the Air, and Jose is being awarded the Defying the Odds Award because of some of the hardships when you came to this country that you... He went to high school... At Shawnee Mission North, is that where you
eventually,
were?
Eventually,
And he was a little bit of a troublemaker.
Yeah.
I self-confessed troublemaker.
I got kicked out.
May be more than a little bit.
So, it was quite a bit.
Yeah.
I'm surprised they didn't kick me out my junior year, honestly. I think I'd done enough. But no, I got into a fight with a teacher.
Like a physical fight?
Yeah.
Oh,
he was.
Wow.
He had actually been the football coach. And I had quit playing football because my mother kind of laid the law, you know, you have to take care of yourself. You have to get a job. And so I quit the football team, but I also started doing drugs. I remember what happened was I was in the hall, and we were getting ready for quarter exams. And I was coming out of the lunchroom, and I felt a hand come over my shoulder, reach into my pocket and pull out my cigarettes. We weren't supposed to smoke cigarettes, but everybody smoked cigarettes. And so when I saw that hand coming over, my first instinct was to just turn around and hit. And I hit the hand. actually hit the wrist. The pack came out, he grabbed it, and I realized it was my old football coach. I said, oh, this is not good. The reason I hit, too, is because I had a joint in the pack. And I thought, well, you know, that's going to be trouble if I don't get that pack. And I just compounded it because, like I said, we were having quarterfinals. They suspended me pending a hearing, but I didn't want to miss my quarterfinals. So I snuck back in, and he caught me. And that's when we got into another altercation.
Wait a minute. This is so ironic to me.
No.
The fact that you're sneaking back in to take a test.
Yeah, it was two tests. And the funny thing was the teachers knew I was suspended, but they let me come in and take the test. And I was just coming out of the hall. He was coming out of this class as I was leaving one of the classes. And boom, the minute he saw me, he just came right at me. And we just faced off.
Wow. So you didn't graduate from high school? You got a GED or something?
No. I started working, literally. I just started doing whatever I could. I needed money. My mother had kicked me out of the house because I'd gotten kicked out. And I had made up my mind that I was going to go back to college. And at that time, you didn't need a diploma to go to college. So I went and enrolled at Johnson County Community College.
Okay.
I started there. And I was at the mall down the street from it, at Oak Park Mall. And I heard this lady call my name, and I turned around. It was Mrs. Brown, my high school counselor, who had convinced me to go into college prep program. And she saw me, and she was really enthused and happy. And she says, what are you doing? I told her, I'm going back to school. And she said, what classes are you taking? I told her, and one of them was the American National Government History. And she said, you know, Jose, you only needed one class to graduate. It was American Government class. And she says, if you get that class done, you send me the transcript, we'll award you the letter. But what struck me the most was that 2 years I had not seen her. She remembered the one thing I needed to graduate. And it floored me. I don't think I've ever really gotten over that. I think sometimes we live our lives in this kind of bubble where we don't realize the impact we have on other people or how other people are impacted by us or how they help us. And she had remembered me, and to this day, I've never gotten over it.
I wonder if when the incident happened, if she thought it was an injustice and that they should have tried to keep you in school.
Oh, no, it was no injustice. I was going down a really bad path. So, no, I think it was deserved in a way.
Do you think that's what turned you around? Or had you turned around before that?
I mean, it's not that easy. I don't want to get into the details of it because I've been very private about it, but friends of mine ended up going to prison. We got robbed one time and a guy shot at us. I don't talk about it, but really the thing that turned it for me is there was a gun in my head and the guy fired it and it didn't go off. The guy behind in the car with me had been in the service, so his reactions were like fast. He threw his hand through the window because the next shot that fired went off. And I remember my foot just instinctively hit the pedal. I had a really nice Mustang and it just took off and the next three bullets hit the car. And I know as a matter of fact, in the weeks that followed, I started thinking, why the heck am I doing this, you know? The whole altercation had been because somebody else had been robbed of their dope. And because they had been my childhood friends, I felt like I had to be there with them. But in retrospect, it didn't take me very long to realize this is not going to end up well for me. And they ended up going to prison. But for me, at that moment, the easiest thing to do was, honestly, that's when I decided I was going to move to Missouri. I think within a month, I had moved to Westport. And my friends were not going to cross the state line, you know. Moving from Overland Park to Westport was like moving to a foreign country. So that friendship started to die.
You really have defied the odds.
Well, I defied a guy who couldn't keep his gun clean. Honestly, when I got told that I was winning this award for defying the odds, I was kind of embarrassed. I said, what kind of odds? I mean, I don't think I had any odds against me. But then I've been thinking a lot about it, and I'm going, I think I was lucky, very lucky. I still don't think they were odds in the sense that I think the award defines them. But a really interesting thing happened to me. I was working with young kids. Some of them were involved in gang activity. And I was very frustrated. I really was not reaching the kids. And I remember saying to myself, you know, what the hell am I doing here? I don't think I'm helping them out at all. And then I thought, wait a minute. What are these kids involved with? Drugs, rebelliousness, ditching school, staying away from home, sneaking out, getting shot at. I did that. That really kind of like hit me hard. I think sometimes we can brush over certain, I mean, I know for me it was denial perhaps, but those things kind of slap you back. So thinking a lot about what this define the odds means, I think it's just luck, honestly.
Wow.
A lot of luck. There's always something that you can take advantage of. And luck sometimes is that you took advantage of an opportunity that came. You were lucky. It was presented. You took it. When that bullet didn't go off, I was lucky. But I took advantage of it within months. I had left. Within 2 months, I was no longer around with them. Luck only goes so far. You have to act on it. But defying the odds is still a strange thing to roll off my tongue. It feels like I'm getting an award for breathing. Because I think you just have to live your best life, even though most of the time you're not.
Looking at your most recent book, The Life and Times of Jose Calderon, This book is interesting because it goes between very realistic things to almost surreal imaginings, but you deal a lot with race and borders and the writing life. Mm-hmm. I mean, you take all of these and mix them up. What was the impetus for putting this collection together?
I put out a chapbook that it's called This Town Like That. I was looking at my connection to the city because I've fallen in love with the city.
I mean, this city being Kansas City for our radio
Both
listeners.
Both the Kansas and the Missouri side because it's a strange border we have, you know. To me, it was kind of like I had all these other poems and I was realizing I was telling a story about an immigrant. There was that idea of how does one create a life in a place that they don't really know? You can be very insulated, you can close yourself off, and he is. Jose Calderon basically wakes up one day and asks himself, have I lived a life worth living? You know, have I lived a life worth anything? And he doesn't think he has. And the book is about him eventually discovering that in fact he has.
The foreword of this is really wonderful because he goes to a market and he meets this woman who is kind of mystical, you know, that's a wonderful person that in a way puts him on his path.
Yeah.
I think I'll get you to read. Number one is Jose Calderon Supposes.
Oh, yeah.
And this will give the audience a sense of this character that weaves throughout the book.
On the 50th year of his life, Jose Calderon buys a set of black moleskin notebooks, a feather quill relic pen, and a set of professional calligraphy inks. He climbs the three sets of stairs to the attic, newly converted into a writing garret. He sits at the desk near the open window, facing out onto the street below, and dutifully removes the plastic foil from the pack of notebooks. He arranges them on the sparse desk, opens the first page, creases it back, lays it flat on the tabletop. He dips the quill into the inkwell and sets about to write the profound arc of his life. 20 minutes later, the ink dries on the nib. He moves away from profundity, searches the significant achievements that are his life's narrative. An hour later, he ponders the absurd moments that surely fill his 50 years. 2 hours later, he watches the dogs chase their tails in the neighbor's yard, watches the squirrels jump into the trees, and at the slightest sound, freeze, turn, and stutters before returning where they began or proceeding to where they meant to go. He watches the play of hundreds of swifts diving off the power lines, marvels at the well-played dance of dips and swoops and plunges, the orchestrated sudden stops and turns, a set of convulsing elastic bands stretching and pulling away from a center and springing back to pull away again. An hour later, he opens his eyes and lifts his head from the sweater-covered arm that has become his rest. He feels the weave of the sweater etched across his face, sees the sun in its last descent. He looks at the blank page and begins to write. Seconds later, the quill on its rest, he rises abruptly, walks to the door, steps out, and closes it behind him. In the room, on the desk, across the top of the page, a name written clearly in block letters fades in the dim evening light. He couldn't think of anything but his name.
That's one of the early poems from the book, The Life and Times of Jose Calderon. and it's called Jose Calderon Supposes. Borders are really important in your work. The story that you had in the collection, Cuentos del Centro, Stories from the Latino Heartland, had to do with a migrant worker. And, you know, I got this sense from one of your poems in here about how artificial borders are, and they're always changing. I mean, when you think about the history of the United States, the Spanish, how they moved borders when they were here long before the English were here, all the native peoples that were pushed out of different states, the borders that kept flexing between Mexico and America. And there's one poem that I thought might be interesting for our audience to hear. It's called Border Crossings. And it's the beginning of the second section, which is called Border Crossings.
Their spirits walked across the plains, rivers, hills, and mountain ranges, along ancient paths carved by roaming herds, heading south, farther from winter's snow and ice. The carved line defiles the Badlands as ashes and distant fires rage along the banks of the Platte and Colorado. Fire rings beneath the shelter of rock overhangs, or in the opening of caves above the winding rapids, or water flowing south deadly along the arroyos, canyons, and valleys, tracking with the flocks and the seasons. Torn vestments, strands long since turned to dust and carried along like the whispers of faces around the communal fire, with songs flicking in the air like lightning bugs, the crackling embers of brush, mesquite, aspens, oaks, walnuts, sentinels. A whistle resonates across the desert and rustles the wide grass of the plains, howls along the ridge of mountains, wakes spirits, the bridge and the way to that home beyond the four corners. The elders carry it in suede pouches and bless the path with sage and oils. The old women built monuments of stone, marked the brown and red earth that seeped through veins into the heart, the tracks of buffalo and boar, puffs of dust, signposts for the return. Many migrations south till the histories reside in the chants of curanderas, in the dance of shamans and elders, the detritus of people on the move, swallowed whole to disappear into a memory, instinct, a pale reminder of a path back to the beginning, to the womb, to the motherland. A squat, thick-chested brown man walks along a river valley heading north. His eyes cast downward to the dirt and rock beneath his feet. He studies the topography and blinks. Now and then he stoops, gathers rocks and pebbles, mounts them on top of each other, recreates the sturdy towers no more than a foot off the dirt. He reconstructs the ancient highways. He is the indigenous returning to the land. And I stole that line from somebody.
Oh, you did?
Luis Rodriguez came here and he wrote La Vida Loca and many other things, but we had him here. And we were talking about immigration and how, you know, it used to be many years ago you would see immigrants coming in, but now you see them coming further and further south from the Yucatan. And he made a comment, and he says, you know, why are we so upset? Is the indigenous returning to their land? And I thought, that's a great line, I'll steal it. How do you put a border when your life is tied to that land? How do you even justify something like that? I saw a great meme the other day, you know, about building the wall. And it was, yeah, Mexico will pay for the wall if we can go back to the 1848 boundaries, when Mexico extended into Idaho, Utah, Wyoming, you know. So to me, it's always been this sense of, I don't understand borders.
Border Crossings from the Life and Times of Jose Calderon. And we're listening to Jose Faust here on New Letters on the Air. And we're in Schofield Hall on the UMKC campus, where he is getting an alumni award in 2019. You've given back to Kansas City a lot over time. You're on the board of the Friends of the Library. You're on the board of the Charlotte Street Foundation, which is a little over 20 years old now. It and it's really helped to revitalize the whole art scene in Kansas City. But I was really taken with a poem that you wrote that I think is a poem that praises something about Kansas City that we take for granted, and it's published in this collection, Finding Zen in Cowtown, 30 Poems About Kansas City, edited by Jason Ryberg and Jeanette Powers. And this one, I think, is fun. It's called It's a Food Town.
Yeah. She says it has always been a blues town, even when it was a jazz town. But she's wrong. It's a food town, because I can't choose between costillas and chile verde up on Summit or samosas piping hot on Lexington, scalding foe in the market, dumplings on 39th Street, chicken spadini on 5th, or gyros, falafel, and pizza at the Curve. And I don't want to argue Gates, Bryan's, Jack Stack, LC's, Oklahoma Joe's, or your granddaddy's all night long, Italian and Austrian in the freight, peppercorns above the trains, peaches from the tree, or double cheese and grilled onions on Broadway or Baltimore, taquitos on Central or Independence Avenues, greens in Eden's Garden, strutting chickens north and south, pollos ricos, shrimp birani, sashimi, remoulade, ooh la la, mix the bunch and bring me ice sweet tea and bourbon on the side.
It's a Food Town by Jose Faust from the book Finding Zen in Cowtown, 30 poems about Kansas City.
I had never really had bourbon and iced tea on the side, but I told Jason Reberg I had, and so when we had the book reading, he started giving me bourbon, and it's good. it's really good. You find the right tea.
Well, Jose, would you like to pick a poem for us to end with?
Oh my God, you pick it.
Well, we could go to poetry from the Latino heartland. What do you look for, love?
Oh, yeah. What do you look for, love, in the mornings when you wake or the nights when you dream? The signs that will come and knock you to the ground to be smitten when all desires to give in are foreign to your nature? How will the rocking come when your hands and feet are so steady to the floor? You ask more of the world than I can give. All the planets must align following the arc of a full eclipse. Hawks and eagles in unison soar, and ladybugs and butterflies fly and crawl in pilgrimage to your door. 5 stars must end every horoscope, in the lines of the I Ching, in the tarot cards, blind prophets in the street and psychics on the screen must all agree. The gray clouds that hover must part, and the sun's light shine the name of the one written clearly at your feet. Then celestial choirs of hosannas and hallelujahs will fill the air, and cherubim and seraphim will blow the trumpets high, and everywhere goodwill will fill the void, and nations for a second will stop, hold their breath, and weep that the cosmos has found the one you seek. Oh, that the world were so, and it were I that would be the one so clearly writ. But if not me and all this should come to pass, what marvel it would be to see the universe in such conspiracy. I believe in love. I've tried it many times.
Yeah. Jose Faust at UMKC's 2019 Alumni Week celebration, reading What Do You Look For, Love, included in the 2008 anthology Primera Pagina, Poetry from the Latino Heartland. His book, The Life and Times of Jose Calderon, was published in 2017 by 39 West Press. For links or to hear more, visit our website, newletters.org, and search for the Latino Writers Collective for more poetry by Jose Faust and other members. Sign up for a free podcast under Ways to Listen or wherever you get your podcasts. If you like what you hear, consider donating to our literary organization. The Support New Letters button is in the top right corner of newletters.org. We're also on Facebook, Tumblr, Twitter, and Instagram. A production of UMKC's New Letters magazine. Partial financial support comes from the Missouri Arts Council, a state agency. Today's show was produced with Amelia Romine, Opal Roberts Baca, Natalie Stein, Robert Zimmerman, and Jamie Walsh. I'm Angela Elam for New Letters on the Air.